Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. To air is human, and so is airing over and over again. We fall for offers that sound too good to be true. We take on too many tasks. We say yes when we should say no, and no when we should say yes. We are, says my guest today, behavioral economist Dan Ariely, predictably irrational, endlessly susceptible to freebies and placebos and self-defeat, and he's got the data to prove it. This hour, On Point, the consistently irrational decisions we make and why we make them. Joining me now from Duke University in Durham, North Carolina, is Dan Ariely, professor of behavioral economics at MIT. His new book is Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions. Dan, thanks for being with us. It's great to have you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You say we are all pawns in a game whose forces we largely fail to comprehend. Irrational pawns?
That's right. And it's interesting that we fail to understand the influence of all of these forces on us. And although we sometimes recognize irrationality in our spouses and bosses, and when we come to think about our own behavior or the behavior of people in general, we do think about it in terms of being rational.
It's easy to sit around and say, that makes no sense when someone else has done something. But are we really doing things ourselves all the time that make no sense and blithely unaware of it?
We have experiments on all kinds of things that happen, but I can also tell you some stories about myself. And usually the way I start doing this research is observing something about myself or some friends and then trying to examine whether this happens more generally. So let me give you an example. A few years ago, we were expecting our second child, and we figured out we needed a minivan because of the amount of equipment we keep on carrying around.
Okay.
So I went and I found out the right minivan, and I didn't buy it yet. And next door, there was an Audi dealership. And the Audi dealership had an interesting offer outside that says you get free oil change for 3 years. And I was sufficiently intrigued that I walked in. And I walked out the next day with an Audi A3, which was tiny, with clearly not enough space for all the stuff that we needed. But I had free oil change for 3 years. And I drove this car quite excitedly for a few months, thinking how wonderful it is to get this free oil change for 3 years. And even when I went to change the oil, I was quite excited. And then some months later, I calculated it. And I figured out that I saved $150. Now, Audi could have made me a couple of $1,000 discount and I wouldn't have gotten this car, which was clearly the worst car for us to get as a family. But something about the free just excited me. Now, it turns out I'm not the only one.
Yeah.
And I kept on doing experiments on Halloween and in shopping malls and in different things. And a lot of people are susceptible to free. And when something is free, it's just a little bit too exciting for us. It attracts us a little too much. And sometimes we take the wrong path of action because of that.
Okay. So you're looking at this as a behavioral economist, and that's got you focused on maybe on the free oil change for 3 years that maybe drew you over to the Audi lot. But I have to say, and I know behavioral economics is very big these days. We've heard a lot about it in Freakonomics, and you're predictably irrational and all over. But when I listen to your story, I don't hear economics. I hear something more, I don't know, Freudian. I mean, you don't want to be a dad in a minivan. You want an Audi. You want a sports car. It sounds to me more like just you're looking for an excuse not to be the family man with six car seats.
So the comparison, by the way, I had to buy a minivan at the end of the day, so it did cost me a lot of money, and I'm driving a minivan anyway.
Okay.
But the issue is the following. Compare how attracted I was to this free offer compared to how attracted I would have been to $1,000 off. And the issue is that the $1,000 off would not have been enough. But the free somehow expanded beyond the $150 and became much more exciting than its financial value. And that's where the irrationality comes from. That I didn't look at it and said, here's $150 I'm saving. It somehow became much, much bigger.
You know, economists come in and they put data to lots of things that humans do, and it really does make for some fascinating observations. At the same time, it seems pretty important because so much of the organization of our economy, our democracy, is based on the assumption that we are rational actors, that we do what makes sense. Are you saying that
more often than not, we are not rational? I mean, are we irrational? Does that undermine our understanding of market economics, of democracy?
So it's hard to say if we're more rational or less, more or less rational all the time, and what are decisions that are kind of in terms of counting the number of decisions we make. But I would say that we're often irrational, and we're particularly irrational with big decisions. Think about like savings or healthcare. I think those are the big things, and there are actually a lot of irrationality in them. And if we understood the ways in which we are irrational, we might actually behave, create better policies that would get people to behave better.
Give us some examples on something that we can see how it matters in life beyond your lovely Audi A3.
Okay,
tie it in.
So let's think about healthcare. People just don't take sufficient care of their health. We do very little preemptive testing of all kinds of things, and we just don't do daily routine that would get us to be healthier. Mm-hmm. Now, let me first tell you a story about my students on procrastination, and let's come back to healthcare.
Okay, good.
So as a professor, you know, the thing I see the most is procrastination.
Mm-hmm.
Every year, my students come to class in the first lecture eager to do the best they can, clean notebooks, promises to be ahead of the reading. And toward the end of the semester, there's always, you know, strange diseases and dead relatives.
Right.
And
the paper's not done, the book isn't cracked, and they put it all off.
They need some extra time. So a couple of years, I offered my students a deal. I said, you owe me 3 papers this term, but I'm giving you a chance for you to commit to when you want to submit them. Mm-hmm. Now, when you set up the date of when you want to submit them, you can always submit them early, but if you submit them later than the date that you committed to, you will get 1 point penalty for each day that you're late.
Okay.
Now, if the students were rational and the class ended May 2nd, they should have said, I'll submit all the papers on May 2nd. I'll commit to May 2nd. If I can submit them earlier, I'll do that.
Mm-hmm.
But what if the people know that they're rational? They know that if they say May 2nd, they'll start working May 1st. And they will work all night and produce bad quality results.
Mm-hmm.
Would they then space their deadlines throughout the semester and actually use that to force themselves to behave better? And the good news is that they did. They spaced their deadlines and indeed they got better grades.
So they're very rational.
It's not rational. They recognize the weakness and they're using a tool that I gave them to overcome that weakness. Being rational meant they would never procrastinate and they wouldn't have to take a costly deadline to force themselves.
So how do you apply – can you apply that to our healthcare reform or something else? Can you save the nation with that insight?
Well, you know, there's one way to be rational and there's many ways to be irrational. There's not going to be one solution that fixes everything. But let me tell you how this would work out in healthcare.
Mm.
Imagine I'm your physician and I'm scheduled a colonoscopy for you for May 28th. What's the chance that you wake up?
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, my pleasure. What's the chance you'll wake up that morning and feel that today's a good day for colonoscopy?
Pretty slim.
Now imagine that I did the same trick that I did with the students with you. And I said, Tom, look, today when I'm scheduling this thing for you, why don't you give me a check for $300? And I'm not going to deposit it unless on the May 28th you don't show up on time.
Okay.
Now you're going to wake up on May 28th and you're still not going to feel like colonoscopy, but you might be very leery of losing your $300,
mm-hmm.
and therefore you might actually show up on time. So here is a way that we say, look, to the extent that you recognize your weaknesses, why don't you pre-commit to something that later would force you to behave better? And the good news is that when we test a mechanism like that, many people are willing to take it. Many people are willing to risk losing money for the benefit of having it force them to behave better in the future.
So recognize our irrationality, build systems and structures that take it into account, we end up with a better outcome.
That's right. Think about another example for this is retirement savings.
Yeah.
From an economics perspective, it would have been great to not do direct deposits from our checking account. After all, why do you want to commit to saving a particular amount of money at the beginning of the month? You don't know how much you'll need, what will be your requirement. It's better to leave that to be more flexible. And at the end of each month, you would think to yourself, how much should I save and send that check to your whatever is holding your retirement
mm-hmm.
fund. But of course, we recognize that if we leave it to our own decision at the end of each month, we will probably not save at all. And in fact, it's good to have a mechanism that works for us, that keeps it outside of our thinking. And at the beginning of the month, just take the money out of our checking account.
But that's so obvious. It's almost just, it almost seems like logic. I mean, all the way back to wherever you want to, the Ten Commandments. I mean, how many zillion years ago was that? They knew we needed guidelines to keep from being self-destructive.
Yeah, you know, so I think we don't understand the extent to which we need these guidelines, and we don't understand always the ways in which we fail when we don't have them. Think about the healthcare example, right? This is a slightly more sophisticated mm-hmm. mechanism than reducing your money from your 401k. But even the 401k example, you know, it took many, many years for economists to convince people that we should have opt-out rather than opt-in retirement savings mechanism with 401k. So they were fighting for years and years and years with legislature, telling them that this is a good idea, until finally we accepted that single idea is a good example. But there are many more things like that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the dependably irrational side of human behavior with an economist who's tracked the patterns in the crazy things we do. Dan Ariely is with us, professor of behavioral economics at MIT, author of the new book Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions. And I should say, you can read an excerpt from Predictably Irrational and test how rational you are at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's go right away to Augusta, Georgia, and Lynn. Lynn, you're on the air with the behavioral economist. What do you think?
Hello, Tom. My question is more multifaceted, I suppose. It's not just about money, you know, or mm-hmm. why I'm not doing this or that. But, you know, for me, and what I see in our society, is everyone doing, including myself. I mean, I'm so easily distracted by whatever is the loudest thing going on, be it leaving my kids. Some of us leave our kids in daycare to go work at a job, when, you know, maybe our best job is staying home with our children and raising and nurturing
yeah.
them. I mean, maybe in the long run, that's the best financial decision, that our children be, you know, whole and nurtured. And yet we sell out those things. We sell out even taking care of ourselves to the point where, you know, you go do things for other people and forget to eat breakfast and take your vitamins, you know, I mean, just right. down to the little things, from the little small things like that on a daily basis to the, of course, the larger picture things. And I'm wondering, why do we do that? Why do we just sort of go into that la-la space of not really being conscious about what we're doing and how it's going to affect us in our lives?
Lynn, let us pick it up. Dan Ariely, Lynn wants to live a little more mindfully, it sounds like, but she feels like she and maybe many others are sort of running in circles. How do you hear that? Is time pressure and crowded lives, is that part of what breeds irrationality, or is irrationality there even if we're just sitting in a cave meditating?
It's hard to say what irrationality is there is sitting in a cave meditating, but I think there are two interesting points here. The first one is that actually making decisions is very hard. And we have a lot of experience with decisions, and sometimes we think that because of that we're very good at it. But if you reflect on it for a minute, you would realize how difficult it is. And just to give you an example, imagine that I gave you a piece of chocolate.
Okay.
It's sweet, it's melty, it has a little nut inside. You chew it, you smell it, you enjoy the taste. And then I ask you, how much money are you willing to pay for it? Not how much you paid for it or how much does it cost in the store, but how much pleasure is it giving you?
Okay.
And how would you translate this pleasure in terms of money? It turns out it's an incredibly difficult exercise. And it takes, once you think about it, you realize how difficult it is. So even though we make those decisions all the time, they're very, very hard to do. So now the decision that the caller had is actually much more complex. How do we weigh off things that are much more difficult than chocolate and so on? And it turns out that because it's so difficult, we often just follow rules in society and do what other people have done or what seems to be acceptable and so on. The second point from the caller has to do with what we call keeping options open. And it turns out that we have a tendency to try and keep as many options open, and we hate closing doors on our options, even if it's bad for us. And we've done all kinds of experiments to show it, but maybe the simplest example is to think about dating. So imagine that you're dating three women, and you're trying to figure out which one is the best one to stay with for a long time or to get married
to. Okay.
And you're sampling one, you're going out to dinner and movie, and you figure out something about her, and you sample the next, and you sample the third, and you kind of keep on dating them. And you figure out that one of them seems to be the best. But the other two are still around, and you're not sure that the one you picked is the best. But you do think you're not sure it's the best, but you think she's the best. Now, here is the issue. When the two women that are less attractive to you are threatening to go away, they say, look, if you don't date us at least once a week, we're going to go and find somebody else. Will you have the tendency to try and date them just to keep the options open, just to keep them around? And what we find in many experiments is that's what people do. They spread their effort across too many options. They try to keep all the options alive. And in the process of doing so, they hurt the main objective. They hurt the main person that you think might actually give you a good life.
Or to our caller's point, they want the job and the kids and the minivan and trying to have it all, as we say.
That's right. That's right. And it's a very hard tendency to fight. I see it all the time at MIT, of course, when the students are trying to major in too many things at the same time. And as a consequence, they don't get really good at anything. So it's a general tendency that we do all the time.
So, and end up losing all three women or the peace of mind that our caller's looking for, perhaps.
That's right. Yeah. I wish I had a simple answer for her, but you know, I'm just good at pointing the problems.
Let's go to Mark in Hudson, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan, I guess, of this whole idea of cognitive errors, and one I'm particularly fond of is called the sunk cost fallacy. Tom Buffett, the big investor there, says. When you find yourself in a hole, stop digging.
You cut out a little bit. Did you say the sunk costs fallacy?
Yes, that's right, sunk costs. So when you find yourself in a hole, stop digging.
Okay.
Where I invest in a stock and it goes down and I keep saying, oh, I'll wait till it comes back, I'll wait till it comes back, where the smart investors would bail and take that money and put it into something that's going to go back up.
maybe. All kinds of advice right now. We're getting timely. So what do you see there, Mark?
Well, I see this sunk cost behavior in Iraq, for example, where the justification for staying in Iraq is we don't want to dishonor the people that have already died there. And it's a way of justifying a mistake. We've sunk in all our energy. Let's not get out until we've solved the problem, but that we created the problem in the first place.
Well, you put some big ones on the table there between a market that's going down. We've seen that lately. A war that's not easy. We've certainly seen that. Dan, are you prepared to bring your behavioral economics to these?
Yeah, so I think it's exactly a correct point, is that in some sense we shouldn't care about water under the bridge, but in another case, in many sense, we care a lot for it. So if we bought a stock for 100 and now it's at 90, we feel a very hard time selling it. And I think in some sense the easiest way to see it today is in the housing market. So my wife and I are currently looking for a house, and it's very interesting. You see people that are very attached to the price they paid for a house. The market is not in the same situation as when they paid for it. Mm. And people are willing to keep a house on the market for months on, paying all the time a mortgage and insurance and not living in it because they moved somewhere else, just because it is so painful to sell it at below the price that they originally bought it for. I think that's actually artificially what's happening in the stock market. And if you think about the housing market crash that happened in Boston quite a few years ago, that's basically what happened. People were just having houses on the markets for months and months and sometimes years, refusing to sell them at a loss, but at the same time, every month losing money for mortgage, insurance, and so on.
On the other hand, when it comes to, let's say, the stock market, is it so clear what's rational or irrational? Our caller says, you know, don't hang on to a stock when it's falling, but you can read plenty of other advisors these days saying, don't bail out now when it's low. You know, you won't be there when it comes back.
There's a big difference between selling a particular stock and getting out of the market. And in general, it's very hard to figure out what's rational and irrational in the stock market because it's very hard to experiment with it. But imagine the stock of company X that you bought at 200 and now it's at 90. Now, if today you had an option to buy that company's stock at 90, and you would say, no way I would buy it at 90, it's not worth it, it also means it's not worth it for you to keep it, because you should evaluate every stock from today to the future. So if you say, this stock is at 90 and I think it will go to 70, you should sell it. If you think this stock is at 90 and I think it will go up, you should keep it. It doesn't matter what price you bought it in the past. The losses you've made are over the bridge. It's sunk cost, as the caller said. But we have a very hard time separating that price that we bought the stock from.
You write about what you call anchoring, and some of your experiments show just how sort of flighty or frivolous we can be in deciding how to anchor our expectations. You asked one of your classes at MIT when they were bidding on particular items, before they bid, just to write down the last two numbers of their Social Security numbers. And whatever that number was, it appeared to influence bids they were willing to make on products sitting in front of them that had nothing at all to do with their Social Security number.
That's right. So we basically went to a big class and we asked everybody to write down the last two digits. So what are yours, for example?
Mine?
Yes.
Jeez, no, okay, 7-2.
7-2. So we gave them different products, chocolate, books, computer accessories, wine, and you would write next to each of them 72. And we would ask you hypothetically, would you pay $72 for each of those products? Yes or no? And you would write yes or no.
But I'm way too smart to bid on the basis of my Social Security number, aren't I?
Well, you're not supposed to, of course. We actually told the students just to make sure you realize your last two digits have nothing to do with your preferences.
Yeah.
But then, after you finish answering the first question, would you pay $72 for this, yes or no, we ask you to participate in an auction. Everybody submits a bid, the highest winner pays, and so on. It was a second price auction. Mm. We explained the rules, and people bid whatever they bid, and we found the highest bidder, and they paid the price, and everybody went home with their products, or the people who won the products.
Mm.
And then I calculated the relationship between people's Social Security numbers and how much they're willing to pay. And people with higher ending Social Security number, you're in that group, were willing to pay much more for things, sometimes twice or three times as much. Now, you might worry that this is maybe the reason why you're spending too much money, is you would just happen to be born with a high ending Social Security number.
Right.
But of course, that's not the reason. The reason is that once you started thinking about each of those products in the range of 73, that thought remained with you and influenced your next thought about it. The problem is that we don't want to think from scratch every time, and therefore we start by thinking about what we have done in the past. We rely on our past behavior, our past thinking, and that's actually how we create habits, rather than think very carefully about each decision from scratch.
But that means context for any decision is incredibly important, whether it's how much you're willing to pay for a Starbucks coffee or whether you're willing to support, let's say, a war.
That's right. In fact, some of my friends did a study like this with National Public Radio. When you say, can you get people to think differently about how much money they're willing to contribute to National Public Radio, and will this actually influence how much they're willing to donate? And the answer is absolutely yes.
Well, you just shout out a big number and people belly up to it?
There's ways to make it better. I don't know if you want me to give all the tricks out. But it turns out it's not just about a number appearing there. If I say 10,000, how much would you do? It's about getting people to think about that number as a starting point. And once they start thinking about it, it again penetrates the next thought.
I'm sure that's used far beyond public radio. I can only imagine. Dan, let me get a call here from Amherst, Massachusetts, and Howard. Howard, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Hello, Dan. One of the reasons why I think that people act irrationally is that they're not capable of making rational decisions. And the classic example I think of is people's inability to estimate probability that something will happen. And the example that often comes up is the Monty Hall problem, where you go on a game show, and there are three doors, A, B, and C, and the host, Monty Hall, ask you to, there's a prize behind one of the doors, $1 million, and there's nothing behind the other two doors. And you are asked to pick one of the doors, and you pick door B, let's say. And Monty Hall looks behind doors A and C and opens up, one of them has to be empty, and he opens up an empty one. Let's say it's door A. And you are asked if you want to stick with B or switch to C. Most people will stick with B, but in reality, it's the prize is twice as likely to be behind door C. And nobody gets this.
Yeah, but are you suggesting then, Howard, that it's not that we're irrational, we're just mathematically challenged, we don't know our probabilities?
We are mathematically challenged. Our intuition in estimating probabilities is flawed. You know, unless we go through rigorous mathematical training, we are fundamentally incapable of even making an estimate. So you only know it's irrational when you apply your intellect to it.
Howard, let us pick it up. Dan, how about it? On Deal or No Deal, when Howie Mandel is there with somewhere there's a briefcase full of cash then, are people making good or bad decisions based on rationality, irrationality, or just, low math scores?
So I've never watched that show, so I don't know how it works. But I think Howard makes a couple of good points. And I think the first thing is, should we expect ourselves to be rational? Now, if we look at the world that we have designed for ourselves, we build shoes and hats and all kinds of things, pens. And when we build those things, we take into account our physical limitations. We don't think that we are as capable as Superman, and we build products for people with our physical limitations.
Okay.
When it comes to things that have no physical part to it, but only cognitive parts, when we build annuities and insurance plan and retirement things and so on, for some reason, I think we assume more rationality. And as Howard said, estimating probability is one of those things that we don't seem to be doing very well. The question is, why do we even assume that we're doing these things well? And what would happen if we start assuming that we don't do these things well? How will the world look different? I mean, should we really create a world that is full of these Monty Hall problems that create situations for us which we can't possibly solve?
I mean, so let's say for baseball, we know that it's tough to catch barehanded, so you build a glove that helps people catch that whizzing hard ball. If we were to make comparable structures more widely, what would some look like then?
So think, for example, for the idea that we said earlier about how difficult it is to think about how much you're willing to pay for something. It turns out that when you think about retirement and retirement saving, it's very hard to think about intertemporal trade-offs between now and later. If you go ahead and you buy something today, a new radio, a cup of coffee, what you should be thinking about is what are you giving up in the future for the benefit that you're getting in the present. But of course, it's incredibly hard to think about, right? This cup of coffee could be a movie in 2 years or a book in 3.5 years, mm. or it could be something else in 17 years. So we just don't think this way.
Or you could save it and then see it all disappear when the market goes down and wish you had spent it.
Well, depends how you save it. Yeah. But so what we're doing in the Media Lab right now is we're trying to create a piece of software that we call concrete budgeting that would hopefully help people realize not only what they're giving up in the present for the future, but what they could be getting in the future if they make this sacrifice. Basically, think about the things we don't do well and try to think about how do we augment them, how do we fix those things.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the dependably irrational side of human behavior with an economist who's tracked the patterns in the crazy things we do. Dan Ariely is with us, professor of behavioral economics at MIT, author of Predictably Irrational, the Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions. Dan Ariely joins us from Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. You've got some examples here, some questions you raise and answer for us. And one is, why our neighbor's home renovation makes us so unhappy? What do we learn there, Dan?
So one of the issues is that when we think about ourselves and our happiness, our salaries and so on, we do it very much in terms of comparisons. It's just very hard to figure in the abstract, in the absolute way, how happy we are. So what do? We compare it to things around us. And we don't compare it to everything. You don't compare your happiness to everybody in the world. You compare it to the things that are similar to compare at the moment that you're comparing. And therefore, your neighbor plays a huge role.
Is that irrational? After all, they're right next door, and so they're maybe the best point of comparison.
You should First of all, you should know what you're happy with and what you shouldn't be happy with. And what you happen, who you happen to live next to should not really matter for your own definition of yourself and your happiness.
That's a lot to expect, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, you know, in some way, I think there's many different ways to think about rationality. Economics think about it in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think your questions basically are about what's reasonable to expect for human being. And you're saying, look, this is what we do and what we can do, and maybe this is perfectly reasonable. We just don't call it rationality. But in general, I think you're right that we should think about what can we expect reasonably for people to behave, and how do we behave compared to that standard, and what does it mean? But from a purely rational perspective, mm-hmm. from the perspective that individuals can compute everything and understand everything and have no cognitive limitations, your happiness should be compared not to your neighbors, it should be compared to whatever your standards are for happiness. The fact that you might want to go ahead and fight with your boss about the pay raise because your neighbor got to fix their house or something, or they got a pay increase, is not particularly rational, but it is how we are.
Here's a provocative one. You ask us to think about why women at Mardi Gras are willing to show their breasts just to get some worthless beads thrown down from the floats, I guess. Okay, we're all ears.
I think what we fail to understand in many cases is how much the environment changes and how much when we're going to be in a slightly different situations, we're going to completely change how we view the world. And I'll give you two examples for this. One is something that is probably familiar to you. Have you ever gone hungry to a supermarket and as a consequence got too much food that later spoiled in your refrigerator?
Sadly, yes.
Have you learned after doing it once never to do it again?
Sadly, no.
I mean, what is basically happening is that when emotion take over, when you become hungry, you become a different person. And not only a different person, but you become a person to the extent that you don't recognize how different you become. When you become hungry, you don't really understand how fast you will not become hungry. And we actually tested this in the domain of sexual arousal, which is, of course, something very familiar that people do all the time. And particularly, we tested it on students. So this was particularly familiar to them. And we asked the question of how much do people recognize themselves in a different emotional state? So we took some students and we put them in what we call the cold state, an unemotional, unaroused cognitive state. And we asked them questions about their sexual preferences. Will they enjoy, you know, being tied up, having sex in all kinds of ways?
Okay.
There's a whole range of activities we asked them about. Then we asked them questions about respect to women. Mm-hmm. Would you tell a woman you loved her, even if you don't, just to get her to go to bed with you? Would you try to get them drunk, drugged, and so on? And finally, we asked them questions about condom use. In this and this situation, would you use a condom? Are you afraid of STDs and so on? And people were asked to say how they would behave when they're aroused. So these students were unaroused, but they were asked to predict how they would behave when they're aroused. Then we took the same people and also some new people, and we asked them the same questions to predict how they would behave when they're aroused. But this time we gave them the benefit of also being aroused. We gave them a little pornography.
Okay.
And we asked them to self-stimulate to a certain level.
And, you're a very devoted scientist. Okay, we got it. What'd you find out?
We found out that people became dramatically different. The same people that had a very conservative sexual taste all of a sudden were interested in all kinds of strange activities. They all of a sudden thought they would respect women much less. And all of a sudden, they didn't think that they would use condoms very frequently, and the probabilities of STDs looked to them like much smaller and much less worrisome.
But that seems to go back to just a kind of fiery human nature that we know. Maybe, again, I'm going to what's reasonable, not what's rational, but who expects to be people to be entirely rational when they're, you know, out there on the edge of passion?
So this is exactly the point. So, you know, if you think evolutionary, emotion was very important. If you go to the jungle and you see a tiger, you don't want to start thinking, should I run, should I stay, what's the cost, what's the benefit? You want a system that takes over, and when it takes over fully and makes you run like hell and go away. Now, emotions still work in the same way, whether it's the stock market or whether we fight with our spouse or whether we're driving and somebody else seems to cut us off and we get what's called road rage.
Mm-hmm.
They're not always good. And in fact, in the modern world, they're creating more bad than good because we don't have tigers anymore. But we still, when they operate, they still work in the same way. And when they take over, they do take over.
But human rationality can come in here. You remind us that when people are asked to recall the Ten Commandments, just to think about the Ten Commandments, experiment finds that their tendency to lie is diminished. So structures can be interjected here, or thought structures that affect that behavior.
That's right. But again, this is not something that people predict will happen. So let me describe to you quickly the experiment. Mm. So we get students at Harvard, MIT, Princeton, Yale, UCLA, and so on, and we give them a set of simple math problems that everybody can solve given enough time, but we don't give it enough time. So we give them 20 questions and we say, please solve as many as you can. We'll give you 5 minutes, and at the end of 5 minutes, we'll pay you $1 per question. At the end of this, the average student solves 4 problems and we pay them $4. Another group of students, we say, please solve the same thing. At the end of the 5 minutes, we say, now shred the piece of paper and tell us how many you solved correctly. Surprisingly, those students solve 7. Now, they don't become smarter, they just cheat. And it's interesting that it's not that some people cheat a lot, it's that a lot of people are cheating a little bit. Now, here are the two more most perhaps interesting and bizarre experiments we did on this. In the first one, before the students came to this experiment, we did another experiment in which half of them we asked to recall 10 books they read in high school, and the other half we asked to recall the 10 Commandments. The question is, will thinking about morality change how people cheat?
And
the answer was that after people recall the 10 Commandments or spend time thinking about the 10 Commandments, there was no cheating whatsoever. It's also the case that everybody stopped cheating. It's not as if the more religious people who remembered more commandments cheated less, and the people who didn't care much about religion and didn't recall any commandments cheated more. It was that contemplating morality was enough.
So when they say go to church every Sunday or show up in synagogue, maybe they've got a point.
It's very possible. In fact, we're doing some surveys now with some Catholic priests about confession, and we try to understand what's the role of confession. If you think about it, if you go to confession on Sunday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the right time to commit crime is Sunday morning because you're going to be forgiven so quickly. Now, I don't think that's what confession does. So the question is, what does confession do? And is it a little bit like the Ten Commandment experiment that he just gets it to people's minds? But here is the most disturbing experiment we did.
Okay.
We have a third of the group that solved it and we paid them $4, a third of the group that shredded it and said, Mr. Experiment, I solved X problems, give me X dollars, and they claim to have solved 7. We had a third group that when they finished solving the problems and shred a piece of paper, they said, Mr. Experiment, I solved X problems, give me X tokens. And we gave them a token per question, not a dollar, and then they walked 12 feet to the side and exchanged a token per dollar. Now, in some sense, we paid them not in money, we paid them in something else that became money later. Now, Here is the intuition about this. How would you feel about taking a pencil from work compared to how would you feel about taking 10 cents from a petty cash box? I'm not looking for your answer on this, by the way. But the intuition is that it's somehow much easier to take a pencil than to take cash.
Actual cash.
So would the students would the students cheat more for the token than for the money? And the results basically show that they doubled their cheating. Now, this, I think, has potentially huge implications for society. Think about backdating stock options. How many steps is that removed from cash?
Because you're not putting your hand into an actual barrel of cash and pulling it out. It just seems like, oh, I'm changing a number on a page.
That's right. It's not money. It's stocks. It's not stocks. It's stock options. It's not asking for more. It's just changing the date. And it could be that when things are many steps removed from money, it actually becomes increasingly easier to cheat and feel good about it, or at least not feel bad about it. It could be that a person could steal millions of dollars by backdating stock options, and the same person would have never dipped their hand into a petty cash box and take a few dollars.
Dan, let's go to our listeners. We've got lots lining up with questions for you. In Moortown, Vermont, Cindy is calling. Cindy, you're on the air.
Hi. I just have one little question. Is there a difference between the way men and women react to these things? Are women a little more rational, or men, or is there any difference between the sexes?
Not much. So in most of the experiments we do, we record usually gender, and we try to find out if, you know, women try to keep less, fewer options open, or if they cheat less or cheat more. We haven't found much evidence. There's a few things that other people have found small evidence, but in general, there's much more similarity between us in those deep cognitive structures that influence our rationality than differences.
And are you more or less, admiring of human beings since you've begun this? I mean, do you admire us because we somehow survive in spite of this? Or, you know, or you think, oh, we're so irrational, forget about it?
You know, I'm fascinated. I think that's the right way to think about it. Irrationality is kind of a nice thing, and it could have been a better world if we had it. But I think that people are fascinating. You know, for me, I go to coffee shops and I talk to people, and I continuously think about, isn't it wonderful how we behave? And it's so interesting. There's a huge mysteries in us, and I'm just a big admirer of that. And then on top of that, you know, I keep on thinking that the real hope is to try and figure out ways to improve things. You know, my own journey into this came from the question of how do you improve treatment in hospitals to burn patients. Mm. And I do think that there's kind of important ways to say, if we understand the mistakes we make, what kind of steps would we take in the world to make it a better place?
Let's go to Matt in Wilmington, Massachusetts. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Fascinating show. I have a question for your guest about how rationality is defined in these experiments, and I wonder if I could just tell a very, very short story. Mm-hmm. That last year, before the subprime meltdown and all that, my wife and I decided that it would be sort of financially would make most sense for us to sell our house because rental rates were low and we could take the difference we were paying on mortgage interest and pay that to our retirement accounts. And,
brilliant use. So did you sell the house?
So we sold the house, mm-hmm. but here's the point, and that you wouldn't believe the grief that we got from people just because I think home ownership is such a thing in the American mm-hmm. psyche. So friends and family all said, you know, oh, no, don't sell. And we asked for, okay, well, tell us why. And there really weren't reasons. It was just this kind of, you know, you're an American, young American couple, you have to own a home. But we sort of bit the bullet and we sold it. And now, of course, we're very glad we did. But here's the point is that I could imagine someone saying, well, listen, you know, we like money, but we also like these certain relationships we have with people. You know, we want to be kind of considered just an average couple, and we want our
right.
parents and our friends to be happy and think that we're, you know, part of the team, the American team and everything. And if we had decided to sell the house, to keep the house, it wouldn't necessarily have been irrational, right? I mean, it would have been financially disadvantageous. But there were other costs and benefits besides dollars.
Emotional concerns and social norms. Our time is growing short, but Matt, let us have Dan respond. Dan Ariely.
So Matt is correct. In fact, it's not always easy to show whether a particular behavior is rational or irrational. And I think that's one of the reasons why standard economics that hails rationality has survived for such a long time. Because when you look at one of those dilemmas, should you keep a house or not, it's very hard to do something. And this is why we don't actually start by looking at people's behavior in the market and say this is rational or irrational, but we try to bring it to an experiment that isolates the environment and creates very clear incentives for people to behave in a certain way, and then we can see if they behave in a certain way and what forces influence them. The second part mm-hmm. of rationality is that whether people understand the way that they behave. So if you say, I like my house because I enjoy the social element, or I don't like the social element, or it's fine like that, it's very hard to say anything about rationality. But when we do an experiment like the Ten Commandments or the one with the token, and we pay people to predict correctly how they themselves or other people would behave, and they don't predict well, in fact, they fail to predict, they lose money on this, it means that we don't understand the forces that influences us.
Let me just ask you, we've only got a minute left, but we've been in a big conversation in this country for years, a kind of a spectrum of debate of sort of government intervention, big brother, some would say, versus market economics. And you've got, you know, supporters and opponents on both ends of that spectrum. Where does your research leave you? Let the market take care of it, or try to design, you know, interventions by the government or someone else to compensate for our irrationality?
I think that once we understand where we're fallible, we should think about market mechanisms to help us do better. I think we should do it in education with the No Child Left Behind, rather than just assuming that if you pay people, they will optimize. We should think about what teachers can actually achieve and not achieve, and what creates real motivation with kids and families. And once we understand those things, we can do better.
Now, are those market interventions or non-market interventions? Or I guess you're saying bring structures to bear on the market that are from beyond the market.
That's right. Mm. They have to be beyond the market. And the important thing is that once we study those things better, we understand them better, I think we could create a much better mechanism that would actually make us much better off.
Well, from Wall Street to Main Street, that may be useful, a useful observation right now, and we're grateful for it. Dan Ariely, professor of behavioral economics at MIT, author of the new book, Predictably Irrational. Professor Ariely, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it a lot.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.